Hello, and welcome to yet another truly exciting and memorable Cooper Talks, and thank you for listening. That sounded sarcastic, which it wasn't meant to, but you know, take it as you see. Anyway, in this episode, I'm here to talk to you about the Kornilov Affair, which is a key element of the Russian revolutions of 1917. And it comes at about the halfway point of the year. Well, it comes in July, which is about halfway, between the February Revolution, where the Tsar had abdicated and the provisional government began to be set up, and the Bolshevik Revolution in October 1917. And the Kornilov Affair is one of the key turning point moments in that period, which kind of weakened Kerensky and the provisional government's attempts to seize power and gave the Bolsheviks an opportunity which they could exploit to gain power. So it's a useful thing to know a bit about. So the context of this was that in July 1917, Kerensky was in the middle of negotiations to kind of make up his new government following all the upheavals in June and July. As part of this, Kerensky appointed General Kornilov as commander-in-chief of Russia's armies. Now remember, the Tsar had basically lost power and been forced to abdicate when he lost control of the armed services, the armed forces. And the provisional government largely was surviving because it had the support of the armed services and the armed forces. So the army is key here, and Kornilov's going to be in charge of it. Now, why Kornilov? Why not someone else? Well, Kornilov had a reputation for toughness, and he was very popular among middle and upper class Russians. Now, the middle and upper classes were a section of the population Kerensky was keen to see represented in his government. So we see here again the class conflicts. Kerensky is very much of the middle and upper classes, not the working classes. And Kornilov is popular with those people. So Kornilov was very much what we might call a fighting general. Okay, he was very aggressive. He came from humble origins. His father was a peasant. Not sure about his mother. She's probably a peasant, but I'm not sure. Anyway, he was decorated for gallantry in the Russo-Japanese War, served with distinction on the front line against Germany and Austria between 1914 and 1916, which not many Russian officers and generals could say. In 1917, he'd been there on the spot of the 1917 February Revolution as commander of the Petrograd Military District. So again, a really important player during the Tsar's abdication. And he was increasingly disgusted with what he saw and how the provisional government was setting about things. After the July days had occurred, the problems there, he made little attempt to conceal his wish to restore order in Petrograd. And he thought it was all chaotic and he wanted to come down firm, military rule, military discipline, and ensure the people did what they should and deal with any potential uprisings and protests. And he was certainly prepared to use force if necessary. Now, Kornilov was brave, some might say suicidally brave, his reputation. You know, he's the sort of person who would go charging directly at machine guns, which was very noble, but not very sensible. And his political grasp on the issues was pretty limited. He thought everything could be solved by force. He didn't realise how weak the provisional government's position actually was, and how strong the Petrograd Soviet and the workers and the Bolsheviks actually were in Petrograd. One of his fellow generals actually said of him that he had the heart of a lion and the brain of a sheep, which is possibly not someone you want to be putting in charge of the military. Anyway, when he was appointed commander-in-chief, Kornilov left Kerensky in absolutely no doubt that he had his own political agenda. So again, Kerensky's in a difficult position. He has to appoint him because he needs his support and he needs the army to remain supportive. But Kornilov's basically saying, I'm doing my own thing. He said that he would only take up his post if a series of conditions were met. So Kornilov's basically saying, yeah, I'll lead the army, but you have to do this first. So we see the power dynamic going on here. Now, these conditions were the subject of negotiations between Kerensky and Kornilov, and largely conducted through intermediaries. And again, this is a weird position. Kerensky is trying to impose his authority, but he has to persuade someone to become chief of the army, which is a difficult situation. And it took about 5 weeks. So these were quite lengthy at a time. Russia's still at war with the Germans. It's still in difficulty out at the front. Plus, everything's going wrong in Petrograd. Now, in the course of these negotiations, Kornilov added to his original demands. So he kept asking for more and more. Here's a highlight or some highlights of what he wanted. He wanted desertion and acts of treason by soldiers in the rear areas of the battle zone to be punishable by death. So deserters from the front lines who refused to go out to fight, they were already being shot. He wanted that extended to basically anyone in the military. Okay, so again, tough justice. Well, not even justice. But anyway, it's tough love. Well, whatever it is. It's tough. He wanted the army commander-in-chief to be accountable for his actions, not to the government, but to his conscience and the people. Basically, he said, I want to be in charge and I don't want to answer to anyone. Okay, so he's asking to be a military dictator, effectively, who doesn't have to answer to any government. He wants there to be no interference by any civilian politicians in military affairs. So again, he wants to be able to do whatever he wants in military matters. He said that railway workers and workers in defence-related industries, such as steel production and weapons manufacture, should be placed under army control and made subject to military punishments. Again, basically forcing all these workers into military discipline that would give him direct control and power over them. And he wanted strikes in all industries to be banned for the duration of the war, with violations of the ban to be punishable by death. Which, again, might seem sensible, given all the problems that they had with strikes. But, well, it kind of misread the situation, because the strikers were the ones with all the power, and particularly in Petrograd. And it was just his demands were just unworkable and were going to alienate everyone. Now, we might look at those demands and say, well, hang on, that's crazy. Why would Kerensky agree to these? Kornilov's basically asking to be made the military dictator of the whole of Russia. And Kerensky and the provisional government would have zero power, okay, or zero control over him and the military. But what's startling, and it perhaps suggests how weak Kerensky's position was, Kerensky didn't break off his negotiations at all with Kornilov. He kind of went, oh, well, let's keep talking. The reason for that is he was reluctant to alienate the army's leaders, not just Kornilov, but all the others, because he knew he might need them at some point to suppress disorder in Petrograd. So all the chaos and violence there and the dependence of the provisional government, just like the Tsar, on the military, gives the military a huge amount of power over the government. On the 26th of August, though, it was reported to Kerensky through an intermediary, so again, how true? We're not really sure, that Kornilov had pushed things a bit further and was now calling for the imposition of martial law in Petrograd, basically military rule, making it a police state that he would dominate, and for all civil and military authority to be placed in his hands, basically to become the new Tsar, effectively. And this appeared that Kornilov was just intent on making himself a complete military dictator. And it's only at this point, on the 27th of August, that Kerensky dismisses him as commander-in-chief and just goes, no chance, you've gone too far. So what do we think Kornilov's going to do? Well, you've guessed it. He was absolutely furious and he responded by ordering a detachment of troops under his command, under the command of General Krymov. I'm not sure I've said that right, but K-R-Y-M-O-V. So a group of troops to march on Petrograd. So here we go. He's gone from leading the army and wanting to defend Petrograd. He said, right, if I'm not commander-in-chief, I'm going to send in the troops and I'm basically going to impose myself on all of you because I know best. So he sets that up. And so this seems like a counter-revolution in the making, a revolution against the original February Revolution. And there was a real fear about this, that it might end the provisional government, maybe even see the return of the Tsar or Tsarist rule. So it was really shaky. Kerensky was forced to turn to the Petrograd Soviet for assistance. Basically, the army's not backing him. It's now going the other way. There's a garrison heading towards Petrograd to get rid of him. He needs to turn. The enemy of my enemy is my friends, as Sun Tzu once wrote. So Although the Petrograd Soviet were a bit violent and militant and he couldn't always depend on them, he now needed the Petrograd Soviet to support him against Kornilov and a counter-revolution. So he goes to the Petrograd Soviet and asks for their help. The Soviet mobilized in defense of the capital and brought all its resources, all the people, all the weapons it could, everything. Soldiers of the Petrograd garrison, the Kronstadt sailors that were based in Petrograd, the Red Guards who were part of the communist Bolshevik movement. All of these groups that had been disarmed after the July days because of their military threats, they were now issued with weapons on Kerensky's orders. So we see the shift here. All these radical groups had had their weapons taken away from them and said, no, you're too dangerous, okay, you're going to try and get rid of the provisional government. But now, because of Kornilov's threat, Kerensky's changed his mind and said, right, I need you guys to help me. Here, have some weapons. I'm going to arm you in defense of the provisional government and Petrograd. Now, it's going to work, but it's going to have big consequences. So, in the event, okay, we're thinking there's going to be a big set-piece battle outside Petrograd, but in the event, Krimov's advance on Petrograd ended up petering out without any shot being fired. Basically, because the railwaymen, who were loyal to the Petrograd Soviet, held up troops on the trains. They basically delayed the trains, sent them the wrong direction, and so the troops couldn't get there. So again, the power and importance of the railways and the fact that the Soviet controls the railways helps them control the way Russia's going to work. That's where the real power is here. And crucially, some of the representatives of the Petrograd Soviets, a lot of them Bolsheviks, were able to do spy work and infiltrate Krimov's advancing forces and basically turn the ordinary soldiers against their officers, which destabilized the whole military movement. So in the end, it kind of petered out and they never really got there. So there was no battle. As a result of this, it all falls apart and Kornilov is placed under arrest. He did escape from custody during the October Revolution when the Bolsheviks come to power. And then he was killed in one of the early battles of the Civil War that would ensue. Krimov instead committed suicide after basically his failure to march on Petrograd. Now, that is basically the Kornilov affair. And you might look at it and say, well, what's the big deal? Potential problem for Kerensky, but it ends up coming to nothing. Although the Kornilov affair and the Kornilov uprising itself didn't cause a problem, its impact is crucial, okay? And basically its impact will lead to the collapse of the provisional government. For a start, it left Kerensky really badly damaged, okay? So he's now going to be attacked from all sides. So from the left wing, a lot of people suspected Kerensky of having been a willing participant in Kornilov's counter-revolutionary schemes. They also claimed that Kerensky had, through his apparent willingness to place Petrograd's workers under military control through the various negotiations, shown himself to be an enemy of the working class instead of a friend of the working class. And that's going to undermine him with the Soviet and with the workers and the Bolshevik supporters. As an example of this, after the Kornilov affair, disillusionment with Kerensky was so high that Viktor Chernov, the leader of the Socialist Revolutionaries, actually resigned in protest of Kerensky's sort of failure to support the left wing. So he resigned from the government, which again removes a party that would support Kerensky, and it undermines the strength of the provisional government and the coalition he was trying to build. On the right, all those who were demanding restoration of order and discipline in Russia, and maybe even a return of the Tsar, these are the industrialists who own the factories, the nobility, senior army officers, and all the people that own property and houses generally, the middle and upper classes, they accused Kerensky of political cowardice. And that right-wing argument was that Kerensky, having done the right thing in appointing Kornilov commander-in-chief, should have stood by him and implemented his programme. So basically, he loses the support of the left because he appointed Kornilov and allowed the threat of the army taking over the workers. And he's attacked by the right because he then fired Kornilov and had to get rid of him. So Kerensky has lost support on all sides. The big winner, which is crucial, were the Bolsheviks. So Bolshevik sympathisers had led the successful defence of Petrograd. They were the ones who were seen as instrumental in defending the capital from Kornilov's army. Many of those who infiltrated Krymov's army were Bolsheviks, and the Red Guards and the Kronstadt sailors were all Bolsheviks. So the heroes of Petrograd here were Bolsheviks. So the Bolsheviks were able to project themselves in propaganda as saviours of the revolution, that if it hadn't been for them, Kornilov would have come in and that would have been an end to the revolution. They'd be back to Tsarist-style dictatorship. So, having been on the defensive after the whole fiasco of the July days, the Bolsheviks are now in a position to go back on the attack and try and seize power. It's also worth remembering that after the Kornilov affair, there was a surge in popular support for the Bolsheviks. Membership of the party increased sharply, and the Bolsheviks polled strongly in city council elections that took place in August and September, actually winning about a third, 33% of the vote in Petrograd and 51% in Moscow. So they're in the driving seat here. Most significantly, they started to win control of Soviets in other major cities. And by the end of September, Trotsky, kind of one of the key figures, he'd returned from exile in May and committed himself to the Bolsheviks in July. He then became chairman of the Petrograd Soviet. So Trotsky is going to be a really dynamic and important figure for helping the Bolsheviks secure control and win power. So the fact that he now becomes committed and chair of the Petrograd Soviet is a big win for Lenin and the Bolsheviks. And by this time, the Bolsheviks also controlled the Moscow Soviet. So they now control the Soviets in the two main cities of Russia. In several other cities, Soviets were dominated by other coalitions of Bolsheviks with left-wing socialist revolutionaries and some of the Menshevik internationalists. Don't worry too much about that, but yeah, other groups dominate. But the Bolsheviks have become the dominant force. And the stranglehold that the mainstream social revolutionaries had had in the defence of the Mensheviks on the Soviets had been broken. Okay, so the Bolsheviks have won. They're in the driving seat. They've basically got control over the Soviets and the working class, and they now dominate and win popular control over a lot of major cities one way or another. It is worth bearing in mind, though, that even so, just before the October Revolution, although they were popular, the Bolsheviks didn't have majority support across the whole of Russia. Yes, they were popular in the big cities and industrial areas, but most of Russia was rural and peasants, and they did not have support in those areas. So big winners in the cities, particularly Petrograd and Moscow, but those are the only places they got mass support. Now, the Kornilov affair wasn't the only reason for this shift in opinion towards the Bolsheviks. Other factors were at work too. The Bolsheviks were better led and organised than any of their rivals, so to Lenin's credit here, and they had fewer internal divisions. They mostly agreed with each other on what they wanted. The policies Lenin had set out in his April theses, they grew in appeal as 1917 wore on, particularly the promise of bread and peace. And people go, yes, we like some bread and peace, please, because we're hungry and we don't like war. So in an increasingly polarised society, the Bolshevik idea of depriving the middle and upper classes, or the rich, of political rights became very attractive to a lot of the people of the lower classes, who started resenting. They had so little, they now start resenting what the others had. And someone who says, yes, we're going to take from the rich to give to the poor, they go, oh, I like that idea because I'm poor. The rich were less keen on it, but that's perhaps less of a surprise. And also the fact that Trotsky now becomes a Bolshevik, and he's probably the best known revolutionary in Russia, and an amazing public speaker, that's significant too. And of course, it's also worth bearing in mind that Kerensky's decision to arm the Petrograd Soviet and all those supporters now means that they are weaponized, that they have military strength in Petrograd. So when they choose, when the moment is right, they are going to have the weaponry to actually storm the Winter Palace and basically remove the provisional government. So the Kornilov affair then, although it might seem like it wasn't a big deal, because it petered out and Kerensky survived in the short term, actually it was a big deal because it really damaged Kerensky's reputation with both the left wing and the right wing sides, Plus, it sees the Petrograd Soviet being rearmed, which is going to make it easier for them in the future to take on and defy the provisional government. And it sees a surge in support for the Bolsheviks, particularly in the major cities like Petrograd and Moscow. So the Kornilov affair is really important in understanding why the Bolsheviks would be able to seize power in October 1917. But that's a story for another time. So there's a bit of a whiz through, a kind of significant event of 1917, but I hope you found it interesting and useful. And I'm sure I will talk about something interesting and motivational again in the future. But thank you as ever for listening. Do give feedback or let me know what you're thinking if you can in the comments or whatever. Otherwise, take care and I will speak to you again soon. Goodbye.